The topic is post-execution, after your trusts are created, what are the planning and maintaining duties for operating your irrevocable trust? We'll start off with the most important piece, which is we believe you took advantage of an exquisite opportunity to move assets into trust. We thought that that ship had sailed, or as I said, for the second half of 2012, that ferry was the last one leaving Nantucket Island on Labor Day weekend, and you needed to either get on it or stay the winter. Turns out there are more ferries, and that's good news. But for the people that put assets into trust last year, we're hearing stories of those who funded the trust with $5 million or roughly so, enjoyed appreciation in the market of 20% if they chose the most aggressive part of their portfolio to put into the trust. And so that $5 million was up 20% in the first quarter, and so now their trust has $6 million in it, which then puts them in a position that an additional $1 million will be free of estate tax, both state and federal, and could be a 50% savings just by doing that before year end. So there are advantages, and we'll continue to drive that point home here as a firm sooner rather than later to get the assets into the trust, because allow that growth to take place off your balance sheet, over the compound wall, but still accessible to your loved ones and to you. So we think it was, and continue to view it as a great strategy. For those of you, this topic will also be, should we put more into this trust? If we have the opportunity, should we do a second trust for our spouse and having the assets? And we each one has to be reviewed individually, but the general very strongly held view here is the answer is yes, as long as there is access to it. So, number one, all trust accounts, real property owned by trust and life insurance policies are correctly titled. So you'll know that step five of our 10-step wealth and family values protection plan and process, John Kiley and now Donica Miscali in our office are charged with meeting with you, reviewing the transfers of these assets and making sure that they're in trust. The trust means nothing unless the trust is funded. So the trusts were all created, but the assets have to be put in. Now, this means correctly titling the accounts, correctly identifying for us how the accounts were titled before, so now we can identify for you how the trust, how the accounts should be titled now inside the trust. We want to make sure that if there's real estate, that the deeds to the real estate, the houses, were actually now retitled and recorded, and tax paperwork sent to the local jurisdiction, so that the property is officially inside the trust. Very, very, very important pieces. With respect to your life insurance, once that's put into the trust, we want you to confirm with your insurance specialist that the ownership of the insurance is put into the trust, that you have a separate account that will serve annually to fund the insurance premiums on the trust. These are elementary pieces, but for sure we want to make sure that they're set up. We'll talk in a moment also about the trust checking account. For years, we always indicated to you that we want it to be non-interest bearing. We've also had clients have problems with trust checking accounts because they cannot get linked to their private banking relationships, and so they charge them fees. We think that is sad, and we think you should be assertive as you can, ensuring that these can be interest-free accounts. Important to note that regardless of whether the account gains interest or not, the trust will not file a tax return for that income because the trust is defective, meaning that for income tax purposes, you individually are paying the taxes on the trust account. So that income, that earning, will be picked up on your individual return. Also, finally, with respect to homes, and any other assets that are of insurable interest, personal property. We've had artwork moved into trust before the end of the year of significant seven-figure values. Make sure that the insurance on the property is still in place. So we gave a presentation to the top producers of one of the premier insurance carriers for property and casualty insurance in the company, in the country, which, you know, their clients are people who own $10, $20, $30 million homes or artwork worth the same. And once those pieces are put into trust, it is important that the insurance, the insured now, is no longer the client, but actually the name of the trust. And so we explain how to work that through with the insurance brokers. Number two, how does the tax basis of an asset and its projected future growth affect planning? What swaps can we do? So in 2011, when many of you put your trust together, there was a concern that by December 31st, 2011, that the ability to move the $5 million into trust was going to evaporate, and that President Obama was going to cut the two-year window in half. So we found many of you creating trusts at the end of that year, and we found many creating trusts at the end of 2012 when we knew that the rule or was scheduled to end, just putting cash into the trust. Or putting in whatever the easiest asset was. We explained then, as we have now, that the assets that you can put into the trust, you can swap in and out. That's important because there may be an asset that you have kept in your name for certain reasons, and you expect that asset is going to explode in value, and you'd rather get that asset in the trust versus having cash in it. There are other reasons that you put assets into trust. Maybe it's a $7 million asset, but because it is illiquid and you don't control, have overall control of the asset, maybe you're a limited partner in a partnership, you can discount that asset from $7 million down to $5 million. In either of those instances, that is not the controlling discussion for this topic. This one is, what is the tax basis? So, on a $5 million gift of cash into the trust, your basis is $5 million. Cash is what it is. But suppose it's a townhouse that you owned in Tribeca that you spent $1 million on, and it's now worth $5 million, and you put it into trust. Your basis, your tax basis, is $1 million, and your gain is $4 million when you sell that asset. Well, when you transfer it into trust, that gain continues to be that number, and your basis is what we call carried over, so that there is no change in your income tax structure here. That's important to address because now that the new tax, we know that the $5 million exemption carries forward, we may consider what assets we put into trust based on their tax basis. So we may want to keep the $5 million house in Tribeca that we have a basis of $1 million in our estate, because as you know, when you die, assets that you keep in your estate get a step up in basis on your death. And so when the house is sold after you die, you don't pay any gain from $1 million to $5 million. You have no gain at that point. So an old-fashioned strategy that is now coming back is give away high-basis assets and keep in your estate low-basis assets. That has to be blended with, well, what assets do we expect will grow the most? So as we saw with the securities portfolios of our clients that had $5 million in them in December, they grew to $6 million. Well, that would have been the right asset. If we have a partnership where it's oil and gas that it's worth $7 million, we can discount it down to $5 million, but it's really $7 million, that's a good asset. The flexibility of the trust, however, is that you can swap assets in at later times. So suppose you have $5 million in equities and it's now growing to $10 million. Well, maybe you swap that out for a discounted interest in partnerships down the road. Maybe there is a high basis asset that you put into the trust. Maybe you take those assets and swap them out and leave them in your estate. This is going to be a very, very important concept for you. There are several financial houses that have already undertook this process to do the analysis and to say what are the assets you should put into trust and what should you swap in and out. We are disciples of this and believe that this will be a critical piece. And we believe that we have set up this wonderful beachfront lot for you all. And now it's going to be important that we preserve the shorefront here and we maximize this trust. And one of the ways to do that is to address swapping assets in and out that have different tax bases to them. So be on the lookout for once a year now. We're going to want to sit down and review these with you and come up with the best plan. Do we have the best asset in the trust? Number three, how do we avoid common filing and reporting errors, especially in the payment of income tax? If it's a grantor trust, do we file an income tax return? So there are many views on this piece, and like some portions of estate planning, it is as much an art as it is a science. But those that study from the masters typically have certain continuing themes. Even if their styles vary, they're still within the overall strategy and structure of their schooling. And so the most important piece here is that a grantor trust, you don't pay the income tax. There are accountants, many of you may have your accountants on the call today, who will say file a return each year on your trust and state that no income is due. You may want to take that approach. Another approach is don't file any return at all ever for the trust because it's a grantor trust. There's no earnings, nothing to be declared, and therefore no disclosure at all. We have taken a middle ground here, what we believe may be the most conservative both financially and tax-wise, and that is after the trust is done, we're getting you its own tax ID number. At that point, we recommend that you file one return, state that no tax is due on that trust because it's a grantor trust. You've let the IRS know that you have a grantor trust. You've staked your territory in the sand. And then from that point going forward, we would submit to you no need to file a return. You are also picking up the earnings of that trust on your income tax, on your personal income tax return. That's the whole strategy here. And so it's not in any way that we're avoiding a disclosure. We are showing the income, and we are being responsible for it. So, again, we encourage you to at least address an initial disclosure and file one return for your trust. Okay, next. Now that the trust is funded, what post-funding strategies can be employed to impact the trust to better meet your goals? So we've spoken about swapping assets. There are additional strategies that can be undertaken. So, for example, maybe we want the trust to make additional purchases. It is a living, breathing entity, and we've had scenarios where clients have funded you all, have funded $5 million into a trust, maybe it's a partnership interest, and then you've gone ahead and used the trust as a purchase vehicle to buy more assets of the family. Maybe it's assets in your private equity business. Maybe it's assets in the family trucking business. Maybe it's assets in your hedge fund. In each of those instances, the trust then becomes an acquirer. And even as you've learned from the hundreds of years of mergers and acquisitions, a smaller company can often purchase a larger company when appropriate financing is available. So your trust, with $5 million in it, can purchase, and we think, approximately 10 times that amount. So with $5 million in trust, you could purchase, you could have that trust purchase $50 million worth of assets in your family businesses. One way to do that, then, is if you sell, you individually sell your ownership interest to the trust, you take a note back. And then the trust, with the income that it receives from these assets it now owns, uses that income to pay you back. But you are selling those assets to the trust at a discount based on formula that we talked about in the past, number one. And number two is those assets in theory are growing. So maybe that's $70 million worth of assets that we've discounted to 50, and now you've sold them to the trust, and now the trust has to pay you a note, to pay you back pursuant to a scheduled note, but really that's $70 million of assets the trust owns, and maybe that 70 grows to 100. Well, now you have $100 million of assets in your trust for, you know, obfuscation purposes, a larger scenario than you may be considering yourselves individually. Obviously, we have clients that do this. You guys are on the phone. But the key thing here is now you've moved instead of $5 million, instead of 50, purchasing that 50, you have this additional $50 million of growth that has now inside the trust tax-free. That's one instance. There are many others. There are scenarios where maybe you individually want an asset back that's in the trust. So maybe it's your home and you've decided you want to finance the home, or there are certain co-op requirements in that you now have to own it back. So what you can then do is purchase the house back out of the trust, and a note goes into the trust. And now the trust has an obligation, rather you have an obligation to pay the note off over a series of years, but what you've done is got a particular asset that you need to own in your individual name back in your name, and the trust in the meantime has a debt obligation, has a credit of $5 million. It cannot be something that we just start with the intention of taking the note. It has to be something we believe that was not originally contemplated, because the IRS can look at these as what they call step transactions and saying this was always a strategy just to move it in and take it back out and have a note, and it was never an intention to move the assets in. So we have to look at these on a case-by-case basis. The most important thing, though, is you have this wonderful living, breathing vehicle that has so much flexibility, and it will serve not just as a vehicle to hold the current assets, but to do lots of neat other things. So, but for sure, we want you to keep that in mind. Number five, if you have not considered use the full exemption amount of 5.25, should you consider making additional gifts? You know, going to a surgeon and saying, "Doc, should I cut?" is like going to a trust an estate's attorney and saying, you know, "John and team, should we create the trust? Should we fund more into the trust?" And the answer is indubitably, we say yes. And we say yes because we are oriented to thinking about how powerful the trust is, how it can save on taxes, how it is asset protected. But we also have to be respectful of the fact that our biases lean very heavily towards funding the trust. So we have to step away, and we have to, as a team, and that's the benefit of having all of us living and breathing estate planning all day long, to give us the opportunity to provide you with a balanced approach. So I start off by saying, yes, of course, and the team knows I'm the biggest flag waver and the most zealous about taking advantage of the trust. But one by one, we have to look at it. Do we have other assets that we can live from? Are we okay with our spouse having access to it and our ability to borrow from the trust? What happens if we need to have some immediate cash right away and our spouse passes away? You know, will we be able to access the trust through borrowing? So for sure, we want to look at all of those pieces, and in the end, we want you to feel most comfortable. But many of you have said, look, you know what, I got what I could by December 31st, 2012. Now I have an opening here to give more. By all means, I want to do that. And we agree. We also need to be respectful of the fact that while President Obama said that he agreed to lift the exemption to $5.25 million, how much you can pass free of tax when you die, we thought that that was the end of it. But recently he has gone public to say that in 2018, it's a lot of years from now, of course, but not so far away, in 2018, that he would like the exemption to go back to $3.5 million. He has also proposed in his 2014 Green Book for his budget that he would like to eliminate the grantor trust status of grantor trust, meaning that you get to pick up the tax liability for your trust, which is a rich, powerful opportunity. He's also stated that he would like to eliminate discounts on family-related businesses. So the question here is, should I do the trust? We do have risk that the grantor trust could go away. Should I put more assets into my trust? I think particularly partnership assets. If we do lose the discount, then it was better to put assets in when you're able to discount them, as you are today. Number three, should we fund it up to $5.25 million? Well, take the hypothetical that we that the $5.25 million exemption goes back to three in 2018, and presume that you're one of the class of people that put $5 million in, and you got $1 million of growth in the first quarter of 2013, which is wonderful, but that you got another $3 or $4 million of growth in the next 5 years. So now you're at 2018 and you got $10 million in the trust. So now $10 million is free of tax, both federal and state estate tax. If you had left that in your name and the exemption went from $5 million down to $3, you would now have $3 million free, and the exemption amount went up to 45%, which that's the current plan for 2018. Then you have $7 million subject to a 45% rate, which puts you somewhere close to $3.5 million worth of tax on the federal level, not to imagine another almost $1 million on the state level. So the question here is, with that specter, and we don't know, certainly 2018 is after Obama is out of office, but Obama had to, in his mind, had to suffer through the tax plans of Bush, and so Obama's successor may have to suffer through the tax strategies of Obama. So you do need to be respectful. We all need to be respectful of the fact that there could be changes, and we may want to fully fund the trust up to the maximum amount. Number six, if your life insurance has been transferred to trust, are you properly maintaining the trust and the annual payments? So this is a very, very important concept. In fact, we were on with clients overseas yesterday who have became permanent residents overseas, and they were asking about, first of all, their group insurance that they have through their international company. And the answer is, number one, you can assign your insurance into trust. You don't just have to have your current coverage that you own transferred into trust, your personal insurance. You can have your group insurance as well, depending on whether the company will allow it. Most will. It's an irrevocable assignment of your group insurance into trust. The second piece that's important here is that the IRS's view, and you all know this, and again with John Kiley and Donica Miscali, you're learning that you have to do an annual notice to your beneficiaries that you have put money into the trust to allow the beneficiaries the opportunity to, quote, withdraw the asset and give them what we call a present interest in the opportunity to take the assets out. We're expecting your children and nieces and nephews, if you have multiple beneficiaries of your trust, or your loved ones, whomever that class is, are all not taking the assets out, but for sure you have to give the notice. There is an exception, and that is if your premiums are not sufficiently high enough that you're below the $5,000 amount, which is the amount that is you're allowed as an exemption for your spouse, number one. And number two, if you have minor children and your spouse is the trustee, the fact that your spouse trustee knows you've put in $45,000 into the trust on an annual basis, she is the trustee, knows it's for the benefit of her children, and as guardian, she can not require a written notice. She has received actual notice by virtue of her being the trustee of the account and seeing the money coming in. But we still want you to follow very, very much the format of doing your crummy notices. Another reason, in addition to once a year addressing what's going on with the Obama administration, where the tax planning is going. Number two, reassessing your assets and seeing what are the best low basis assets and high basis assets to swap in and out of the trust, which ones are going to grow the most. Number three is to make sure that you're following the appropriate protocol for the annual notices. The IRS has made it a point in the past several years to say, we may not catch you, and you may do everything correctly when you file your well-prepared, detailed gift tax returns through your law firm. And as you know, we sent letters out early this year saying that your gift tax returns have to be done absolutely highly efficient and detailed. So we get past that. But once we've gotten behind the gate and we're, you know, in the territory, they're also looking to see if you are treating the trust and the businesses that you put into the trust the way they should be treated. In other words, are you giving annual notices? Are you running your LLCs as if they're legitimate businesses? Because after all, you're telling us, says the IRS, that this is a business and you're taking discounts, or is this some contrivance that you've made and it's not a legitimate business? So next step in the appropriateness is to make sure annually that you are doing the things that the IRS may look for you on. They may say you win, you got inside the gate, you're in the castle walls, but now we're watching your behavior inside the castle, decide whether or not we have good reason, and we're looking for it, to kick you back out into the moat. So, I am convincing myself, and the team has been telling me this, that we must be focused on reaching out to you and individually reviewing your plans once a year. For those of you in particular that have done trust planning, irrevocable trust planning. Number seven, when and why should you transfer trust to an asset-protected state? Are there any actions pending against an individual who is a beneficiary of the trust you and the grantor? So for years, I have used the story that if you run into a school bus with your car, or you have had someone slip and fall, or there you have some issue where there is potential liability, if you create a trust and move your assets into it after that point, it is viewed as an approach to avoid being judgment attacked, or what they call a wrongful conveyance or a fraudulent conveyance. Now, if we create the trust today, and the trust is created in New Jersey or New York or any of our clients, Connecticut, Delaware, Pennsylvania, anybody in the Northeast, but certainly since we represent many of you on the phone all around the country, the question is the trust as protected as possible? And our view is that we need to, at those times, consider the four classic jurisdictions, and those are Delaware, South Dakota, Alaska, and Nevada. I'll repeat them again. Delaware, South Dakota, Alaska, and Nevada. Not enough time on this call to review the benefits of each of these. Some of them, the trust's fees, annual fees, are cheaper than others. When you move to that state, you have to have an institutional trustee serve. We'll be talking about that in 30 seconds on paragraph 8. But more importantly is that each of them has a history. So Delaware has the longest history of being the granddaddy of asset protection states. Alaska has the reputation of being the farthest away. South Dakota has a similar history from Delaware in that it is has a long history of protecting trust, and that will be important because when there are cases brought against the trust company, you want to have sophisticated lawyers in that state, sophisticated, well-developed laws, because if they are appealed, the appeal very likely may not take place in the state that your trust is located, and so there isn't the fondness or the affection or the need to defend that trust the same way that a Delaware court would do, or a South Dakota court. We actually found we're making this argument tangentially, but that in Alaska they recently had a case that was appealed and it went to a federal court and they had to go to Washington. Washington could care less about what's going on in Alaska and interpreting the laws to benefit the Alaska Trust Company. So we need to look at each of these for their respective benefits. But if the trust is created before the accident happens and it's a local trust in this area and we move it to that state, well, the trust has already been there, the contract was created, the protection was in place, we've just moved to a more protective place than already, but we've already been inside the compound wall. We are already in the castle. We now may go up to one of the towers, which is even better. Okay. When should you consider an institutional trustee? Well, number one is we're huge fans of institutional trustees because they are they know how to manage money. They are sophisticated in their abilities to make distributions. They have typically have a long history of knowing how a trust should be properly managed. We believe, and the trust companies that we work with and that you've all been involved with, are fine with the idea of putting the trust in place and having the ability to remove the trustee. This way, at least we're in a position where everybody knows that the trustee is only as good as the work that they're doing, and they continue to have to earn it. We're confident that they will. And if you have your money professionally managed, as you all do, typically do on this phone, on this conference, you're paying a fee for that as well. To have them serve as a trustee is one additional benefit and for very modest nominal additional cost. That said, often we hear clients say, I just want to have my wife serve as a trustee or my kids and then have the institution do all the management of the assets for our children. And so we support that. If they have that feeling after we've had our chance to voice how strongly we feel about professional management. Having the trustee, though, serve can be great because if you need to have it set up in one of these typical asset protection states, you get the trustee, you get the asset protection, and you get a blended management fee. Which is valuable. You can also have the trust set up in Delaware, for example, and have your financial advisors in your home state still manage the assets, where the trustee in Delaware just serves less as the investment trustee, but just the trustee to keep to create the home for the trust. Okay, when your trust owns a primary residence, how should you, number nine, how should you cover expenses, insurance, and titling? So we talked about this earlier, but this is important. So there are two types of strategies when we would use our primary or secondary residences. We also did an article on this topic, which was quoted and posted in Reuters. If you want a copy of it, it was published just recently. We also did a seminar on this call-in call as well, what to do with your primary residence and your vacation homes. So if you are giving that asset away to your children and you continue to live in it, or if you are giving that asset away to your spouse and then on your spouse's death to your children, there are two approaches if you're continuing to live in it. Remember that the IRS, again, will accept that the transfer is made. You've gotten inside the compound wall. The drawbridge is up, and you're safe as you breathe a sigh of relief leaning against the wall inside the castle walls. But now they look to see how you're managing it. And so if you're living in it, then the IRS says, well, I've given this asset away, but now I'm still controlling it. And so then they look later on to state, maybe only at the time you pass away, after it's grown significantly inside the trust, to say, sorry, grantor, we're going to call this back into your estate because you have too much control that you've emphasized. So there are two approaches. If your children have that, and as you know, if we, for those of you on the call, that we've set up qualified personal residence trust, those you maintain the right to live in and use for many, many years, and then after that period ends, depending on the term that we set up, then it becomes your children. If you continue to live in that trust, in that property after that period of time, it is our recommendation that you formalize that agreement with your children. There are multiple reasons, the least of which, but some would argue is still important, is to protect your right to continue to enjoy it. And so by having the lease, you've now said that, yes, I'm occupying it to the IRS, and yes, it is a legal arrangement. Now, what could the rent be? Well, interestingly enough, our clients say, well, now that our kids own the house, they don't have the money to pay the taxes, the maintenance, the insurance, and any capital improvements that need to be made as the house requires work. So they're looking for mom and dad or grandma and grandpa in this instance to pay for the expenses of the house. And the way that you capture that is by having a lease agreement. We've had some people just say, here's a lease between the trust and my wife or my husband and myself, and the rent shall be $4,000 a month. And in lieu of paying the trust the rent, we will pay the taxes, the maintenance, and the upkeep directly to the providers and the tax authorities. This is wonderful because it allows your children the additional gift of you paying for the expenses of this house and protects you to always be able to be in the house. And number three, it legitimizes your right to be on the property where the IRS can't come back and say, you gave this away and now you're living in it. We call that an asset clawed back into your estate. Now, some people say, okay, if it's my wife, I'm giving it into trust. And many of you did this, right, because you wanted to have access to the asset to sell it and so forth for your wife's or your husband's lifetime. So husband creates it in my hypothetical. Wife is the beneficiary and trustee of it, children after wife. So as long as wife is alive for the next 50 years, she can sell it, she can do whatever she wishes. There's no timeline, there's no worry that she dies before the CUPRA term ends, because this is not a CUPRA, this is a separate trust strategy. And in that instance, we are giving, since the spouse and you're married to your spouse, there's a whole body of practitioners that say, I don't have to formalize the lease because my wife, just by me being married to her, entitles me to live there. A discussion we can have, but it's most important that we have the discussion, so we go through the scenario. Okay, last, number 10, and that is, how should you make distributions if you have a family business or other corporate entity or partnership? Are there two transactions necessary? So many of you have taken multiple investments and had each of them, for whatever reason, in separate LLCs. So we have, many of you have got four or five commercial properties, and each is in their own separate LLC for good reasons for protected. But then you also then have transferred all those LLCs into the trust. Now a particular LLC is selling the real estate inside of it or refinance, and there's a big cash distribution. That then goes into the LLC, and the LLC account holds it. Well, now you want that money, or your spouse wants it, or your kids want it. Can we cut it right out of the LLC? The answer is no. You must follow the rules of the structure, and that is the LLC owns the real estate or the business. The trust owns the LLC, okay? And your children or your spouse is the beneficiary of the trust. So when the business has earnings, the earnings go into the LLC account. Once in the account, the earnings then can be distributed out into the trust account. Once they're in the trust account, the earnings can be distributed to the beneficiaries outside of it. It is important to follow that format. If those of you who are on the call have decided you want to fund your trust with more assets and you have an S-Corp, S-Corporations are a very, very unique and special ownership entity. We don't use them much anymore. We use LLCs, which are far more advantageous from a trust and income tax planning for the trust. But if you have an S-Corp, these strategies do not work as easily, and it requires work.